Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, August 12th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Going first to the weather for today, taking a look at the forecast. Scattered showers possible with a southeasterly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour, a high of 75, a low of 64. There's a chance of storms tomorrow with a southwesterly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour, the high tomorrow 88, the low tomorrow will be 65 degrees. Then, as we look ahead, we find that on Sunday, the weather forecast for the Cedar Rapids area shows that it's going to be partly cloudy with a northeasterly wind at about 1 to 15 miles per hour. The high tomorrow will be 85 and the low will be 64. On Monday, partly sunny, northeasterly wind 5 to 15 miles per hour, a high of 81 and a low of 59. Today's top weather story is from meteorologist Jan Reihard. It says drought continues to worsen in southeastern and south central Iowa. Severe drought is now present in parts of Keokuk, Jefferson, Wapello, Mahaska, and Poweshiek counties in eastern Iowa, and several others into central Iowa. Extreme drought remains in western Iowa with subtle shifts. Over the last month, it has been feast or famine when it comes to rain. Areas of northeastern Iowa have had heavy rainfall events and even flooding. Dubuque has recorded over 6 inches of rain in the last 30 days. Cedar Rapids, Olwine, Decorah, Independence, and Waterloo have seen 3 to 6 inches of rainfall in that time. These totals cut off quickly to the south, with Iowa City recording only 1.32 inches, Washington 0.94 inches, and Ottumwa 0.37 inches over the last 30 days. And that's today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihard. Let's turn to the front page of today's Gazette, where we find a story written by Gage Meskimen, Federal Grant Bypasses Tower Terrace Project. For the third year in a row, the Tower Terrace Road Project across the north side of the Cedar Rapids metro area will not be awarded a $23 million federal grant that would speed up progress on the massive infrastructure improvement. U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg on Thursday announced 166 projects across the country were being awarded a total of more than $2.2 billion from the Rebuilding American Infrastructure with Sustainability and Equity Program, or RAISE. The RAISE program, formerly known as Build and Tiger, is a highly competitive U.S. Department of Transportation grant. The federal funding could have made a drastic difference in the timeline to complete the Tower Terrace work, which aims to connect a four-lane road from I-380 to Highway 13. Without the grant, the project is estimated to be completed in 2045. However, if the grant had been awarded, the project could have been finished in a decade. While the metro area did not receive any funding, three other Iowa projects did receive awards this year. The city of Waterloo was awarded $20.5 million for its LaPorte Road revitalization project. The city of Dubuque was awarded just over $2.2 million to build a W bridge, and the city of Muscatine got $2 million for enhancements to one of its corridors. The local communities in eastern Iowa will have to wait another year to try again, while simultaneously continuing to chip away at the work on the 8.3-mile Tower Terrace Road. Hiawatha City Manager Kim Downs said, "I am so disappointed. I'm happy there were three Iowa projects funded, but we are going to keep working on it. I've reached out to our team about taking a look at some other dollars to get to work on bridges and other pieces, but we now need to circle back." Marion Mayor Nick Abba Astley said, "We were very hopeful for a successful application, so, of course, we are disappointed with the result. Nevertheless, we can be proud of the work done and the partnerships formed, which will be important as we move forward. Cedar Rapids, Marion, Hiawatha, Robbins, Linn County, and the Iowa Department of Transportation started earnestly in 2010 to plan for the project, though it had been an idea as far back as the 1960s. In 2010, the Corridor Management Plan was adopted by the jurisdictions involved with the Metropolitan Planning Organization, which aimed to take the idea of a completed tower terrace and turn it into a reality. Corridor Metropolitan Planning Organization Manager Elizabeth Burke has said the project has a benefit of $18 for every $1 invested by the year 2050, according to an analyst done as part of the RAISE grant application. The communities together have applied for the grant three times now and have not received it. After previous applications, they received feedback about the application and how to make it stronger. The latest application included over 100 letters of support from businesses, unions, and leaders in the community. Marion City Manager Ryan Waller said, "We are proud of the applications our region put forward and are thankful to our 100-plus partners who submitted letters of support. The benefits of this project to the region are numerous and supported by reliable data. While we are disappointed we were not on the award list this year, we are confident it's not a question of if, but rather when." The remaining cost for the project is about $51 million, with an overall price tag of about $90 million. Last year, the project was awarded $5 million in federal appropriations, which were earmarked as a community funding project by Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson to help engineering work and right-of-way acquisition. Right now, each jurisdiction has $10 to $20 million worth of projects remaining for Tower Terrace: Marion at $21 million, Hiawatha at $12.9 million, Cedar Rapids at $12.1 million, and Robbins at $10.2 million. Currently, the Iowa DOT is working on constructing a diverging diamond interchange on I-380 at Tower Terrace. The project, at $22 million, is separate from the rest of the road's cost and is being split among the state and the cities of Cedar Rapids and Hiawatha. The cities are contributing $2.5 million each, and the Iowa DOT's portion is paid by a majority of federal funds with some state funds. The interchange project is expected to be completed in spring of 2023. Also on the front page today is a story written by Marissa Payne of the Gazette, IRS reinstates CSPS's tax-exempt status. Dateline Cedar Rapids. The IRS has notified iconic Cedar Rapids arts organization CSPS that it has reinstated the group's tax-exempt status, opening access to more funding sources as the nonprofit grapples with charting a long-term path towards sustainability. CSPS was notified in July of last year that its 501c3 status, which allows the group to receive charitable contributions and access to certain grant funds, was automatically revoked for failing to file tax returns for three consecutive years from 2018 through 2020. Now, in a letter dated July 18th, the IRS says it reinstated CSPS's tax-exempt status retroactive to November 15, 2020, when it lost the designation. That generally means any contributions made to the organization that anchors CSPS Hall at 1103 3rd Street Southeast since the announcement of the tax-exempt status loss are now tax-deductible. CSPS Board President Monica Vernon said in a statement, "This is wonderful news for this important community arts organization as we enter a full season of programs to inform and transform. The failure to file those tax returns happened under previous CSPS staff and board members after leadership changes and COVID-19 disruptions already had dealt the group a blow. It worked to pay off more than $100,000 in debt. to plug gaps. While much grant funding was inaccessible without tax-exempt status, CSPS's board was looking to raise $125,000 by the end of 2022 to maintain its operations. Vernon told a small group of supporters in June that the gossip was taking steps to support The group was taking steps to support its long-term sustainability by boosting revenue, focusing on fundraising, and strengthening community connections. Vernon said, "It's also a great boost to our efforts to become sustainable over the long term. We invite all who believe in the value of CSPS to step forward and become a friend of CSPS at some level. It was a tough year without our 501c3, but with the help of our patrons, staff, board, and volunteers, we are working to shore up the health of this jewel in the crown of New Bohemia." The notification of its tax-exempt status reinstatement comes as CSPS is experiencing a leadership transition. Jim Miller last month ended a stint as the interim executive director since January. He stepped in after the departure of Taylor Bergen, the first leader of the organization, after the departure of the group's founders, Mel Andringa and F. John Herbert. A new temporary or permanent leader has not been named yet, but Vernon has said the board will conduct a search and evaluation for leadership. The timeline is uncertain. Bookings were already planned through the next year, Vernon had said. Revival Theater and SPT Theater already were on the calendar for shows, but staff worked to bring in other concerts, new exhibits, and collaborations with the Nubo Czech Village entities in Cedar Rapids, as well as partnering with the Engler Theater in Iowa City to bring Grammy-nominated folk singer-songwriter Mary Gauthier to the CSPS stage on September 17th. On the Iowa Today page, we find a story written by Marissa Payne of the Gazette. Expand ethics language and keep door open for ranked voting. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. The citizen panel reviewing Cedar Rapids' governing document voted Thursday to recommend changes that would broaden ethics language for top officials and also keep the door open for ranked choice voting in the future. The Charter Review Commission on Thursday wrapped up the second review process since voters in 2005 adopted the city's Home Rule Charter. When the charter took effect in 2006, it ushered in a council-manager form of government with 9 part-time council members who guide policies that a full-time city manager and staff execute in the daily operation of the city. It replaced a 5-person council where commissioners set policy and directed city operations. The Charter Review Commission's recommendations will come before the council at its 4 p.m. August 23rd meeting in City Hall. Gary Streit, the Cedar Rapids lawyer chairing the Charter Review Commission, said he will meet with council members in small groups before that meeting to discuss the recommendations and answer questions. Here are the substantive changes being recommended. A hot-button issue the commission took up was how to address citizen interest in exploring ranked choice voting in place of the current runoff system, where a runoff election is held after the general election if candidates fail to receive at least 50% plus one of the vote. The panel on June 22nd opted to recommend trigger language that would direct the council to appoint a future panel to study whether to adopt ranked choice voting should Iowa lawmakers ever move to allow it. Under the recommended language, the city would commit to convening a limited charter review commission within 6 months if the Iowa legislature authorizes ranked choice voting for use in municipal elections. That group could recommend amendments to the charter for the city council's consideration. Better Ballot Iowa, a nonprofit, and some citizens pressed the commission and city officials in Iowa's second largest city to take bold action and lobby Iowa lawmakers to authorize ranked choice voting. Street wrote in the report's cover letter, "Commissioners thought doing that could result in lawsuits and uncertainty in the outcome of the initial elections under the new form of voting." Though the commission decided it did not have the time nor resources to study moving to ranked choice voting, it felt the idea warranted a full discussion. For the section of the charter outlining what constitutes a conflict of interest for top city officials, including council members, the panel recommended broadening language defining a conflict as the use of public office for private gain to personal benefit, financial or otherwise. Current ethics policy states private financial interest or gain is, quote, any direct or indirect economic benefit or other consideration to a city official, their immediate family, or business entity or organization that is not otherwise a benefit or other consideration to the general public and does not similarly benefit the general public, end quote. In addition to those amendments, the cover letter advises the council to ask the Ethics Board to complete a careful examination of the current rules of the Board of Ethics and to also encourage a more robust annual training for those officials who are subject to the city's ethics ordinance. Some council members have expressed concerns that such a standard could conflict elected officials out of a vote or encourage some to sit out a hard vote because of their employment and affiliations. Finally, the panel recommended the council convene a charter review commission every 6 years after this year, avoiding local election cycles in odd-numbered years. The review process currently happens only once a decade. The group's thinking at the June 8th meeting was that this would allow for future commissions to consider changes in local government more as they arise instead of having to consider several weighty issues at a time. Commission member Amy Stevenson, who is the former city clerk, argued at a previous meeting having such frequent reviews, depending on what changes resulted, could be disruptive and confusing for council members, city staff, and citizens. The panel also recommended future Charter Commission membership be limited to those who are not elected or appointed to a city board, commission, or other governmental or political office. Some members, such as Strait, hold appointments on other city panels. Before we move on, there is a correction in today's edition of the Gazette. David Allen Houston, age 53, charged Tuesday with assaulting abortion rights protesters, lives in Swisher, an article Wednesday reported an incorrect city. The Gazette welcomes comments about the accuracy, fairness, and completeness of news articles, headlines, and captions. When the content is found to be wrong or misleading, a correction or classification will be published. Also among the top stories is a story written by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette, former deputy counsel hired as UI top counsel. Dateline, Iowa City. The University of Iowa is bringing back to campus a former deputy general counsel who, for the last year, has been advising colleges on sexual misconduct policies and conducting Title IX-related internal investigations to succeed Carol Reasoner as vice president for legal affairs and general counsel. James D. Jorgensen, who served as UI Associate Counsel and Deputy General Counsel from 2006 to 2018, will start as UI General Counsel September 30th at an annual salary of $385,000. Jorgensen earned a bachelor's degree in economics and political science from Iowa State, a Juris Doctor from the University of Michigan Law School, and a doctorate from UI in education policy and leadership studies. He left UI in 2018 to become chief of staff and chief legal counsel at Pitzer College in Claremont, California. He started as senior counsel at Hush Blackwell LLP in Denver, Colorado in March 2021. In announcing Jorgensen's hire Thursday, UI President Barbara Wilson in a statement said she's excited he'll be rejoining UI in this crucial position. While at Hush Blackwell, according to his resume, Jorgensen advised colleges and universities on numerous issues like student conduct, faculty discipline, and sexual misconduct policies, and he conducted internal investigations under Title IX, non-discrimination, and harassment and retaliation. Hush Blackwell was the law firm that UI Athletics hired in June 2020 to conduct an independent review of issues and allegations relating to racial disparities within the football program, after former black student athletes aired grievances on social media. Hush Blackwell interviewed players and coaches as part of that investigation, and the UI in July 2020 publicly released a 26-page report of external review from the firm. The UI did not, however, release all the Hush Blackwell investigative reports, and players who sued the institution recently took that issue to a federal judge. The judge earlier this summer ordered the UI, among other things, to turn over all Hush Blackwell documents, including reports on head football coach Kirk Ferentz, assistant coaches Brian Ferentz and Seth Wallace, and former strength coach Chris Doyle. UI officials said Jorgensen was not involved in Hush Blackwell's review of the UI football program, which was completed before Jorgensen joined the firm. He did, in his role with Hush Blackwell in November of 2021, conduct a pair of training sessions on internal investigations for the UI, one online and one in person. UNI spokeswoman Tricia Brown confirmed that. Jorgensen's publications include a 2009 assessment of post-secondary litigation, looking specifically at First Amendment issues and institutions that face legal challenges involving organizations refusing membership to non-Christians or gay people. The UI faced such an issue in 2017 when a student organization, Business Leaders in Christ, refused to allow a gay member to serve as a leader. The UI deregistered the group, which sued, prompting the UI to take a broader stance against faith-based organizations that restrict membership, compelling yet another lawsuit from InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. A federal judge in December of last year sided with the student organizations and ordered the UI to pay a combined nearly $2 million for attorney fees and damages. Reasoner has been vice president for legal affairs and general counsel since 2008. Wilson said in a statement, "Carol is the epitome of what is fundamentally good about our institution, and it has been an honor to have had the opportunity to work with her." Let's move to the inside page where we find today's Gazette's editorial. It's headlined, "Scrap Breed Ban Ordinances." The Gazette says, last week, pit bull owners in the Benton County town of Keystone pleaded with its city council to allow them to keep their family pets. The owners were given verbal warnings in July regarding a city ordinance that bans pit bulls within the city limits, and a Benton County ordinance that bans dogs that have, quote, the characteristics of pit bulls. The council took no action, but it should. Keystone should toss its breed ban ordinance, and Benton County should follow suit. And that's because breed bans do not increase safety. Keystone and Benton County should instead craft a smarter ordinance aimed at protecting its residents from dangerous dogs of all breeds and from the actions of irresponsible dog owners. The tragedy of a 2-year-old girl attacked in June by a stray pit bull-style dog should lead to a necessary review of city and county safety ordinances, but it should not be a pretext for forcing families to give up family pets that have done nothing wrong. The trend in prevention of dog bites continues to shift in favor of multifactorial approaches, focusing on improved ownership and husbandry practices, better understanding of dog behavior, education of parents and children regarding safety around dogs, and consistent enforcement of dangerous dog reckless owner ordinances in communities. That's according to the National Canine Research Council, who says effective laws hold all dog owners responsible for the humane care, custody, and control of all dogs, regardless of breed or type. The Research Council is among a long list of groups that oppose breed bans or breed-specific legislation. They include the American Kennel Club, the American Veterinary Medical Association, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Animal Control Association, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and the Humane Society of the United States. According to the ASPCA, breed-specific laws have a tendency to compromise rather than enhance public safety. When animal control resources are used to regulate or ban a certain breed, the focus is shifted away from effective enforcement of laws that have the best chances of making communities safer. We agree. The State Humane Society has offered assistance to local governments to rewrite breed-specific ordinances, and local officials should take it. Iowa lawmakers should also ban breed-specific ordinances in the state, following the lead of Minnesota, Illinois, and South Dakota. That action would create uniform rules statewide, while also prompting communities to consider more effective safety conditions. That way, Keystone families and other Iowans can keep their family pets without fear of an unexpected and unwarranted knock on the door. And that is today's Gazette editorial. And taking a look at the inside page, we have one community letter today. That's from Marjorie Carson Zack of Cedar Rapids, who says, "Let's welcome solar to Linn County. I've been a resident of Linn County for 60 years. I've always hoped to make it a welcoming home for friends, family, and neighbors. In my professional life, my job was to help others add value to their home interiors. I think it is important that we also strive to improve our community. We need to welcome growth and change and open the door for new opportunities. That's why I've been amazed at the group of people trying to hamper the Duane Arnold Solar Project. This is an opportunity to make Linn County a better place to live and work. Duane Arnold Solar Center is projected to bring in $154 million in economic activity to our county. It will bring in 200 construction jobs and pay $7.8 million in property taxes. It also makes practical sense to use the existing lines and land from this facility, which was decommissioned in 2020. The current international political climate has made us aware of the danger of being dependent upon foreign oil. The derecho of 2020 has awakened the awareness of the consequences of climate change due to fossil fuel emissions. We must move forward and look to solar as a part of diverse mix of reliable clean energy to protect our world for future generations." And that's today's community letter from Marjorie Carson Zack of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, August 12th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we'll look at the shorter other notices from Marengo. Curtis C. Kinzenbaugh, age 70, died Wednesday, August 10th, The Clouster Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Shirley Ann Williams Franklin of Tama died Wednesday, August 10th. Assisting the family will be the Cruz Phillips Funeral Home of Tama, Toledo. From Walker, Nadine M. Cook Hines, age 94, died Tuesday, August 9th. White Funeral Home of Independence is in charge of those arrangements. And Terry Lee Cotton Sr., age 79, of Indianola, died Sunday, August 7th. The Cremation Society of Iowa will assist the family. Now let's move into the longer obituaries. Daniel Han Lewis of Marion, age 38, died from a motorcycle accident in Cedar Rapids on July 27th, 2022. A private family gathering will be held in honor of Daniel's life on earth. From Winthrop, Dewey A. Peterson, age 75, formerly of Ely, died at his home in Winthrop on Sunday, August 7th. A celebration of life is being planned from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. Saturday, August 20th at the Woodpecker Lodge in Pinnacon Ridge Park in central Iowa. Maureen Ellen Bergen, age 80, of Elkader, passed away Saturday, August 6th at St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota. Visitation will be from 2:30 p.m. until Mass time on Sunday, August 14th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Elkader. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 4 p.m. Sunday, August 14th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Elkader with the Reverend John Haugen as celebrant. Interment will follow at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in Alcater. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Alcater is assisting the family. Gary L. Cooper, age 70, of Marion, passed away at his home on Tuesday, August 9th, surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Rapids Memorial Park Chapel of Memories on Saturday, August 13th, from 3 p.m. until service time, which is 5 p.m., with the certified celebrant, Dr. James Cole, officiating. Private interment will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made in his name to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Edward J. Casey, age 92, passed away at his home in Marion on Wednesday, August 10th, surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home on Monday, August 15th, from 4 to 7 p.m. A graveside service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery Garden of Tranquility on Tuesday, August 16th at 9 a.m. with the certified celebrant, Dr. James Coyle, officiating. Roy W. Murstick, age 90, passed away at the Northbrook Manor Care Center on Tuesday, August 9th, surrounded by his loving family. A memorial service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories in Cedar Rapids on Monday, August 15th at 10 a.m., with Pastor Pat Reek officiating. Interment will be at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made in his name to the Northbrook Manor Care Center. Turning our attention now to sports is an interesting story concerning the WNBA. Dateline Phoenix, former Iowa All-American Megan Gustafson scored a career-high 15 points for a shorthanded Phoenix Mercury team in an 86-77 WNBA loss to Minnesota on Wednesday. Gustafson was 6 of 10 from the field. Cornell College has named Kurt Lamb the new Wellness Center coordinator and sports performance coach days after opening the new $20.5 million small athletic and wellness center. Lamb is a Des Moines native and Iowa State graduate and will begin his new role September 1st. The former head strength and conditioning coach and associate athletics director for sports performance at Limestone University, Lamb will oversee the training of Cornell's 20 NCAA Division III athletic teams. In the eastern Iowa area, it was a special night just outside the city of Dubuque last night. Here's a story. Once again, it's Iowa baseball night in America. Dateline, Dyersville. Although Thursday's participants were the Chicago Cubs and Cincinnati Reds, the spirit of the Field of Dreams game may have been captured best by a man wearing a St. Louis Cardinals jersey. The Redbirds fan had a vehicle pulled off the side of the road about a mile from the ballpark last night and was offering bottled water to any slow-moving motorists who wanted some. The price? Zero, which was considerably cheaper than what it cost inside the ballpark. "Why are you doing this?" a gridlocked sports writer asked the good-hearted man, who said, "Just because." "Just because" was all the answer that the 8,000 fans in Dyersville needed to give for attending this event. Not everything needs a cosmic purpose. Summer fun is plenty. This technicality was a home game for the Reds, and it seemed like one in downtown Dyersville Thursday afternoon. Red supporters from Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, and elsewhere made the trek to Dyersville, finding something interesting amid another mundane season for their ball club. Ken Griffey Jr., Ken Griffey Sr., George Foster, and Dave Concepcion are star Reds of the past who were in town for this. Judging by the number of Griffey, Johnny Bench, and even Pete Rose jerseys that fans wore, Reds fans missed yesteryear more than any of us. Of course, Cub fans had a considerable presence here to cheer on their also-rans this year. If you're going to be 6 years and a whole lot of glory away from your 2016 World Championship team, you might as well go back a full century. Two young fans held a Cubs Win W flag outside their grandparents' home on the road that leads from Dyersville to Field of Dreams, and many a passing car honked at them to validate their fandom. 12-year-old Landon Sturm of Bellevue said, "I don't know," when asked why he and his 10-year-old brother Eli were displaying the sign. Eli said, "We can't go to the game, so we're holding this up." Tickets were high-priced for lads their age, or anyone else who isn't independently wealthy, but they got to see the Cubs play in St. Louis last week, so that almost was as good. There's no cornfield behind Busch Stadium in downtown St. Louis, but Iowa kids have seen enough agriculture to be unfazed by the novelty of it. Three Eastern Iowa kids got a heck of a thrill before the game last night, though. Jeff Ahn, Oliver Schamberger, and Kevion Estramira were among eight boys and girls who emerged from the cornfield beyond the outfield fence before the game. They had a catch with dads Peter Ahn and Josh Schamberger and grandmother Pat Anderson. The Griffies preceded the eight pairs of family members onto the field. Then came baseball luminaries of Cubs and Reds vintage, like Andre Dawson, Ryne Sandberg, Ferguson Jenkins, Barry Larkin, and Johnny Bench himself. It was 77 degrees with a comfortable light breeze at the 6:23 first pitch. What followed was a game with no consequence to pennant races and no place in MLB lore. But who cared? The sky was blue and the corn was green. The playing field was manicured so expertly that it was almost hard to believe it was natural grass. Technology combined with baseball to present another MLB game in the breadbasket that was beamed across the nation and beyond. Had someone told you 10, 20, 50 years ago that regular season Major League Baseball games would be played in Iowa, you would have assumed something horrendous had struck Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Missouri while somehow skipping us. Nah, it was something nice. A novel was written about baseball and ghosts and families and Iowa. Then a movie was made about those things. Then a tourist attraction was created outside Dyersville, and people kept coming to it year after year. Then a stadium was built. Why? Well, let's go with the same reason given to that kind fellow who gave the boy bottled water to thirsty travelers. Just because. It's nearly time for high school sports again, and there's a story on the sports page today written by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette. New coach brings new attitude to Jayhawks. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A player approached first-year head coach Ed Miles following Cedar Rapids Jefferson's first football practice of the season Monday night and told him he couldn't make it to an early morning weightlifting session because his mother had to work and he had no way to get to school. Miles told him, all right, but he had to find a way to get extra lifting in at a later date to make up for it. Another player then approached Miles and informed him about a groin injury. The young man had been advised by the school's trainer to ice it that night, then come in before practice the following day for additional treatments. Miles nodded at him and told the player, responsibility, all right, responsibility. Rebuilding this program begins with rebuilding the culture. Rebuilding the culture involves demanding individual responsibility and accountability. Miles said, I can say you only need three things to play for me. Mental toughness, physical toughness, and maximum effort. None of those things have anything to do with talent. I was watching film of last year and stuff, and I saw a lot of lacking in those standards. So my thing is simple. I have experience expectations for everybody, and it's my job to coach them, coach each player, to exceed those expectations. Not to meet those expectations, he exceeded them. A former University of Iowa linebacker and NFL player, Miles isn't blind to the situation he's walked into. Make that run into, considering the amount of sprinting players did to conclude their first official practice. Jefferson is on a 17-game losing streak. It went 0-9 last season, its closest loss by 42 points. The Jayhawks had to even forfeit a game against crosstown rival Kennedy because COVID-19 and injuries combined to leave too few available players. Jefferson had just 21 guys dressed for the first game last season. Things unraveled last summer when multiple players decided to transfer to other schools. Other players saw that and decided simply not to go out. The 37-year-old Miles said, what a mess he's trying to clean up. He works in the Jefferson building as a college career transition coordinator affiliated with Kirkwood Community College. He said, we've got to change the perception of Jefferson football. If you see somebody ask, you guys play for Jefferson? Automatically it's followed by, oh, you guys suck. Jefferson sucks. They're trash. I'm not playing for them. A lot of times, if you take a step back, some of our better athletes are not coming out. Then this is not the spot for you, whether you've got a lot of talent or not. About 65 kids in 9th through 12th grades attended the first practice. Miles said he hopes the number of players reaches the 70s by the time the first game rolls around August 26th against Cedar Rapids, Washington. Freshmen and sophomores will be counted on to contribute to the varsity this season. Junior lineman Cade Chisholm said, there's just a different feeling all around. A lot more excitement's going into this season. A little bit more of, you know, everyone wants to be here. Everyone is buying into what we're doing. It's a way better, hard-working culture. It's go time. Junior lineman Colin Woods said, last year felt hopeless almost. This year it feels like we have a chance to win a game, maybe more. All Jefferson players interviewed on Monday said they felt confident their team would break the school's losing streak this season. They said they enjoy the toughness Miles is trying to instill in them. Miles said, I see a lot of potential in all these players. I think they'll be able to turn some heads in the first year. Absolutely. There's a golf story on the sports page today, written by K.J. Pilcher. Says, clubs stolen, Hall still delivers. Dateline, Marion. Cedar Rapids Kennedy's Reed Hall played like he had nothing to lose. Maybe it was because his golf clubs were stolen the morning of the season opening competition. Hall said, I went outside and was going to my car and saw it wasn't there. I was all dressed up ready to go. Then I had to get my brother's clubs from his work. Hall regrouped and still managed to shoot a 1 over 73 for runner-up honors at the Mississippi Valley Conference Super Meet Thursday at Hunter's Ridge Golf Course. Owen Sawyer was medalist, firing 7 under 65 and helping Cedar Falls to the team title. Considering the situation, Hall was content with the first round of his junior campaign and said, I'll take 73 to start the year. It could have been better, but it happens. I've never played with his clubs before. Just go out there and have fun, I guess. Gannon Hall, a former Cougar who is now golfing for Kirkwood, offered his clubs. For weekend hackers, clubs are interchangeable without an impact on the average player. Most competitive golfers, however, have customized clubs that can affect swing and distance. The younger Hall's clubs are 2 degrees stronger, making for about 1 club difference in yardage. Hall overcame the challenge throughout most of the course. He said, that was kind of a struggle. It was a guessing game all the way out. I got a few clubs dialed in that I hit all day. The 2021 MVC Valley Division Player of the Year was precise with his approach on the par 5 17th hole. Hall's wedge shot from 130 yards out just missed the hole and came to a stop, setting up a short putt for his fourth and final birdie of the round. Hall said, I hit a light pitching wedge. It got pretty close. I think it lipped out. It was a pretty good shot. Putting and his work with a 3-iron were strengths. He demonstrated his resilience and mental toughness, handling the events that preceded the conference tournament. Kennedy coach Mike Green said, it gives you an idea of how focused he is with golf. He wants to be really, really good. Sawyer was 3-under on the front and closed 4-under on the back. He birdied 5 straight holes, playing the 9th through 13th under par. The Tigers had all 6 golfers shoot 87 or better, posting a 305 total. Lindmar plays second at 315, 1 shot ahead of Cedar Rapids Prairie, and 2 better than Xavier. Christian Cloyd led the Lions with a 75. Iowa City Liberty finished 5th, followed by Dubuque Walnut, Jefferson, Kennedy, Washington, Iowa City West, and Iowa City City High. Going back now to the top stories page, it's a national story, but with Iowa implications. The National Republican Party chairwoman said it was her intention from the start to maintain the party's presidential nominating calendar and Iowa's leadoff status on it. speaking at a state party fundraiser Wednesday night. Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel said her preference for the status quo is why she put Iowa State Party Chairman Jeff Kaufman on the national committee that determined the order in which states will cast their votes for the Republican presidential nominee in 2 years. National Democrats are having the same conversation, and reports indicate the party is leaning toward a reshuffle of its presidential nominating calendar, which likely would include knocking Iowa from its first-in-the-nation perch. McDaniel said Wednesday night at the Iowa Event Center, "I didn't want to change it. There is a reason why I put Jeff as the head of the presidential nominating committee. It was a pretty good signal that I wanted to keep the map. Because then I knew the Democrats were going to be changing their map. I figured that they'd be changing, and I wanted a very strong signal from the RNC." Asked how many states wanted to supplant Iowa on the Republican side, McDaniel said the conversation never reached that point. She said, "We really didn't have a lot of difference of opinion within the Republican National Committee. We had a very diverse committee on the presidential nominating committee that Jeff was a part of. We had people from every state. They looked at every opinion and every option, and this is where we settled. And there was not a lot of dissension among the RNC, like you're seeing with the Democrats." The Iowa caucuses have been the first early voting presidential nominating event in the country in every quadrennial election cycle since 1972. National Democrats recently delayed their decision on a new presidential nominating sequence until after this November's elections. Kaufman said the biggest bipartisan element of his job is working with Iowa Democrats to keep both parties' caucuses first in the nation, and that he holds out hope Iowa Democrats will maintain their spot. Kaufman said, "I do believe that together we would be stronger, and I think it's the National Democratic Party that is literally just going to run over that." Throughout the event, Republicans warned against becoming complacent in a state that continues to inch in a more conservative direction and to work hard in this fall's elections. Iowa Republicans enter the election season optimistic they will not only maintain their dominance of federal and statewide offices in Iowa, but expand upon that roster by ousting Democratic incumbents in a central Iowa congressional district and in state office. Republicans also spent the night praising police officers and law enforcement, but also leveling heavy criticism of the recent FBI search of former President Donald Trump's home in Florida. In a statement, Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Ross Wilburn of Iowa City accused the Republican Party of being full of right-wing extremists and charged that Iowa Republicans, quote, will always put politics before people. Meanwhile, President Biden and Iowa Democrats like Congresswoman Sidney Axne are fighting to bring down costs for working families, strengthen Iowa's economy, and make sure the ultra-rich and corporations pay their fair share, according to Wilburn. Here's a national story that does have ramifications everywhere. The CDC drops distancing recommendations for COVID-19. The Associated Press says the nation's top health agency relaxed its COVID-19 guidelines yesterday, dropping the recommendation that Americans quarantine themselves if they come into close contact with an infected person. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also said people no longer need to stay at least 6 feet away from others. The changes, which come more than 2.5 years after the start of the pandemic, are driven by a recognition that an estimated 95% of Iowans 16 and older have acquired some level of immunity, either from being vaccinated or infected, according to agency officials. CDC's Greta Massaretti said, "The current conditions of this pandemic are very different from those of the last 2 years. Many places around the country long ago abandoned social distancing and other once common precautions, but some of the changes could be particularly important for schools, which resume classes this month in many parts of the country. Perhaps the biggest education-related change is the end of the recommendation that schools do routine daily testing, although that practice can be reinstated in certain situations during a surge in infections." Officials also say the CDC dropped a test-to-stay recommendation, which said students exposed to COVID-19 could regularly test instead of quarantining at home to keep attending school, With no quarantine recommendation anymore, the testing option disappeared too. Masks continue to be recommended only in areas where community transmission is deemed high or if a person is considered at high risk of severe illness. School districts across the U.S. have scaled back their COVID-19 precautions in recent weeks, even before the latest guidance was issued. Some have promised a return to pre-pandemic schooling. Masks will be optional in most districts when classes resume this fall, and some of the nation's largest districts have dialed back or eliminated COVID-19 testing requirements altogether. Public schools in Los Angeles are ending weekly COVID-19 tests instead of making at-home tests available to families. The district announced that last week. Schools in North Carolina's Wake County also dropped weekly testing. Some others have moved away from test-to-stay programs that became unmanageable during surges of the Omicron variant last school year. The American Federation of Teachers, one of the nation's largest teachers' union, said it welcomes the guidance. President Randy Weingarten said, "Every educator and every parent starts every school year with great hope, and this year even more so. After 2 years of uncertainty and disruption, we need as normal a year as possible so we can focus like a laser on what kids need." Others say the CDC is going too far in relaxing its guidelines. Allowing students to return to school 5 days after infection without proof of a negative COVID-19 test could lead to outbreaks in schools, according to Ann Sosen, a public health researcher at Dartmouth College. That could force entire schools to close temporarily if teachers get sick in large numbers, a dilemma that some schools faced last year. She said, "All of us want a stable school year, but wishful thinking is not the strategy for getting there. If we want to return to normal in our schools, we have to invest in the conditions for that, not just drop everything haphazardly like we're seeing across the country." The average numbers of reported COVID-19 cases and deaths have been relatively flat this summer at around 100,000 cases a day and 300 to 400 deaths. The CDC previously said that if people who are not up to date on their COVID-19 vaccinations come into close contact with a person who tests positive, they should stay home for at least 5 days. Now the agency says quarantining at home is not necessary, but it urges those people to wear a high-quality mask for 10 days and get tested after 5. The agency continues to say that people who test positive should isolate from others for at least 5 days, regardless of whether they were vaccinated. Here's another national story that may have local implications. It's from the Bloomberg News about home availability. They say it's harder than ever to afford a house in the United States, with higher mortgage rates claiming a bigger share of incomes and prices still rising at double-digit rates across the country. The monthly bill on a typical existing single-family home with a 20% down payment jumped to $1,841 in the second quarter, according to the National Association of Realtors. That's up 32% from the first quarter and a 50% jump from a year earlier. Families spent about 24% of their incomes on mortgage payments in the second quarter, up from 19% in the previous 3 months and 17% last year. The median price topped $400,000 for the first time, reaching $413,500. The 14.2% gain from a year earlier was slightly smaller than the 15.4% annual increase in the first quarter, thanks to a slowdown in sales. But that's little comfort to would-be buyers who are stretching to afford a purchase and still getting tangled in bidding wars. Lawrence Yun is chief economist for the Realtors Group and says home prices have increased at a pace that far exceeds wage gains, especially for low and middle income workers. He says overall, the national price deceleration inevitably followed the softening sales, providing well-positioned prospective buyers a small measure of welcomed relief. In the second quarter, 148 of the 185 metro areas measured by the Realtors Group, or 80% of the country, had double-digit annual price gains. That's up from 70% of regions in the first quarter. Meanwhile, the number of Americans who signed up for unemployment benefits rose last week to the highest level since November, even as the national job market continues to show signs of strength. The four-week average for claims, which smooths out weekly ups and downs, rose by 4,500, also the highest since November. The number of Americans collecting traditional unemployment benefits increased by 8,000 the week that ended July 30th, up to 1.43 million, the highest since early April. Unemployment applications are a proxy for layoffs and are often seen as an early indicator of where the job market is headed. So far this year, hiring in the United States has been remarkably strong and resilient in the face of rising interest rates and slowed growth. The Labor Department reported last week that U.S. employers added 528,000 jobs last month, more than double what forecasters had expected. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, August 12th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.